Good morning. Do you remember the feeling? The it's all over, it's all about to begin mix of dread and excitement, because it could all hinge on what was in that envelope.
We didn't have time to bless ourselves during the year, so we worked really hard now, so we're all delighted, yeah. So hitting the town now tonight, so.
Well, I hope you have a great time. And what are your plans for the future?
To biology and chemistry with education in UL, so yeah. Delighted now, yeah, so we get, life can start.
Oh, one of the 59,000 students getting their Leaving Cert results has heard on the news at 1 with Emma O'Kelly, and it is, of course, such an overwhelming feeling of relief. And one student who was particularly proud of her results, though, was Amy Richards from Wexford, and she'd been forced to sit her exams hours after surgery for acute appendicitis. She spoke to Mary Wilson on Drive Time and took us back to when she first became ill.
About a week before the Leaving Cert, I started to get really bad pains in my stomach. So I went to the GP and it was all put down to stress, but I had an inclination that was my appendix, but I kind of trusted what the doctor said. And then it was actually Tuesday, the day before English Paper 1, that I ended up in A&E in Wexford General Hospital, and I was under the knife then at 1 a.m. the morning of English Paper 1. I was brought back to my ward at 4 and I started English Paper 1 at 9:30.
You were brought back to your ward at 4 a.m. and the doctors and your mum had to wake you up at 7, was it?
Yeah, I asked myself, please wake me up at 7:30. I wanted to do a little bit at 4. And sure, naturally, everybody was kind of against me sitting the exams because they didn't want me to feel like I was under pressure to do it. But I was so determined, I just couldn't bear the thoughts of repeating, considering how hard I had worked. So I made the decision myself and I went ahead with the exam.
Now, her parents contacted the State Examinations Commission to see if her exam could be deferred, but this was refused. And here she recalls getting through sitting the exam, or at least what she can remember of the experience.
So when I woke up, I was surprisingly really calm. Obviously, I was really drugged up because I was only out of anaesthetic for 5 hours, I think it was. So I was quite calm and I was very groggy, though. I felt extremely nauseous. That's the one thing that I really struggled with throughout all of my exams, was how sick I was. I actually ended up finishing 2 out of the 3 exams I did in the hospital early to be sick. Honestly, I can't remember English Paper 1. I've said that from the start. It's all a bit of a blur. Yeah, I couldn't tell you what I wrote. So that happened. And then I sort of started to kind of come around for the next 2 exams. But they're still all a bit of a blur, to be honest. English Paper 2 was definitely the toughest exam. I was extremely nauseous. I couldn't finish the exam at all because I felt so dizzy and so sick. I ended up on the floor in my bathroom being sick, and the superintendent had to go out and get my mum. It nearly went on for 4 hours with the added on time from the nurse's intervention, so I just simply couldn't finish the exam.
And she says what kept her going was her complete determination to study medicine. And at 602 points, she got quite amazing results.
Yeah, I honestly don't know how I managed. Maybe there's something in the anaesthetic that just gave me that little bit of extra creativity. I don't know.
And Amy Richards is continuing her campaign to raise the issue of medical emergencies around exams. However, for those who weren't quite so happy with their results, John Creedon had some sage words.
There's enough pressure on youngsters nowadays. I'm aware that just as a family might be very happy that someone has done so well in their Leaving Cert or just got over the line at all, I'm delighted for you, but equally I'm sure there's some youngster sitting in the back of a car someplace who's done badly. As they see it, it might be the best thing that ever happened to them. Trust me, folks, there's things I asked for in the past that I didn't get, and I look back and go, thanks be to God I didn't get that gig, or I didn't get that job, or whatever it might be. So trust me, I don't want to go into a big don't stress about it, folks, because sometimes telling people not to stress or discussing how to help your children get through the best way to say is leave them alone, tell them you love them and good luck with it.
Wise words indeed. But then John Creedon went here.
I mean, talk to the Mayo footballers, you know what I mean?
Low blow, John, low blow. There's no need for that. But if you're from the country and have been offered a place in college in an Irish city, well, now begins the search for accommodation and, crucially, the funding for this student housing. Minister of State with Special Responsibility for Higher Education, Mary Mitchell O'Connor, spoke to Mary Wilson on Wednesday. And here comes the budget bit.
There are 77,430 beneficiaries of SUSE grants. That costs the taxpayer €381 million. Then we have a student assistance fund, and that helps 14,000 students. And then we have a fund for students with disabilities, and that helps 13,545 students. So students are supported, and that's what the SUSE grant means. It's a universal support programme. But it was never, Mary, intended to cover the whole cost of college. We know education is very expensive. I know it myself. I put two boys through university. I came from a farm myself where my mother and father put five of us through.
But
so
Minister,
I know
like
it's very
me,
expensive.
Like me, maybe you were lucky enough living in Dublin that we didn't have the accommodation.
No, I lived in
issues.
County Galway in a little village, Mary.
When you came yourself, but
yeah,
you were in Dublin
yeah.
when you put your sons
and
through
my
college.
Boys, well, I sent them myself, you know, as a lone parent.
I know.
So I know, and I also know dealing with parents, you know, and they contact my office every second day.
I know, and Minister,
sympathy
is fantastic and great, but you're the Minister with responsibility for higher education.
No, but the sympathy,
people are looking to
Mary,
you for more than sympathy at this stage. They're looking
but look,
for action.
Mary, I would love to take out a chequebook and write a blank cheque for higher education. I can't do that. But I wanted to say that there is an investment of 1.7 billion euro into higher education alone. And then there is approximately another 700 million
when?
In further education.
When? 1.7 billion?
Doing,
when?
Yeah.
When is that investment? Yeah, when is that investment?
Sorry, that's current investment every year. That's current investment for 2019.
And the cutbacks that happened from 2008 have had to be made up along the way. You've been playing catch-up.
Absolutely. We, of course, Mary, and that is, you remember that there was a recession in Ireland and we're just catching up.
Catch up indeed. That was the two Marys on Drive Time on Wednesday. Well, listen up, kids. Your very first CAO choice may not be the one you end up devoting your life to. This next man started off as an accountant, but his career took off in an entirely different direction.
Guarantee you probably heard his music, but you haven't maybe necessarily noticed it as such. Is that a bad thing to say? Can
no,
I say that?
No, that's exactly the industry
oh, really?
I'm in. Yeah,
oh, really? Okay, fair enough. Yeah.
Phew is right. That was Ciarán Birch talking to Dave Fanning at the weekend. And Ciarán is a composer of trailers for the films. And not just any old trailers, major box office hits like Avengers Endgame, Blade Runner 2049 and Wonder Woman. But he isn't a man who bangs out the tunes on the piano.
I mean, if you sat me down, if you know, at a piano and asked me to play something amazing, I couldn't. You know, that's not what I do. It's I'll have ideas and feelings in my head and I'll just kind of get those out into a musical sense.
No, he just works off samples on his computer. And this was something he just loved doing as a teenager, in between balancing the books.
When I was in my teens, we had a 4-track and a 16-track recorder in the house. And, you know, I used to mess around with that or little samples of drums. And it was brilliant to have that. I never would have got so excited about that. You get to play with it. If that was a career, if I'd gone into study this straight after school, I don't think I would be where I am today.
Right.
I wouldn't have gotten to play with all these sounds. I would have.
No, you had to do something that you absolutely hated.
Yeah,
to realise anything is better.
You know, at the time, now looking back on it now, it was the best thing that could have ever happened to me to do work in that industry and in accountancy and see that this really wasn't.
But is there any way at all that your accountancy comes in handy at all with anything you do?
It does. It makes me very conscious of my finances and the budget. Yeah. And obviously, being self-employed, you have to watch. You know, you're paying your taxes every year. It does keep you focused. All the friends are slagging me off for having like a million Excel sheets. Do you know, just tallying in different bits. It's great, you know, because with trailers, it could take 6 to 8 months to get paid for a trailer. So you really have to be conscious of budgeting.
So yes, accountancy into composing. That was trailer maestro Ciarán Birch talking to Dave at the weekend. And Ciarán's now in the process of pitching for the trailer for the new Star Wars movie, which is a far cry from his tax office days. So you just never know where life is going to take you. Hong Kong is now in its 10th week of protests at erosion of freedoms under increasingly dominant Chinese rule. After 2 days of protests at Hong Kong airport, Jonathan Head, BBC Southeast Asia correspondent, spoke to Miriam O'Callaghan on Wednesday about the protests and their motivation.
But there's no outside support here, or not significant anyway. It's convenient for China to say this is all stirred up by the CIA and by foreigners. The reality is this is a homegrown movement and that the anger that fuels it is driven by homegrown concerns. you know, chronic inequality, the lack of representative government, an executive authority that's under the thumb of Beijing. And most of all, for these young activists, the reality that in 28 years, they go back under the yoke of an authoritarian Chinese rule. You know, this is, in many ways, they're saying for their generation, this is their last chance to plead for a protection of the freedoms that they still have. And it is a remarkably free place still, Hong Kong, compared to anywhere else I operate in Asia in terms of access to protests and the police. All of that will end within the relatively young lifetimes of the people who are protesting now. And I think that's really what this protest is all about.
And how might China react should these protests continue?
Well, China might decide that the chaos is unending, that the local government here simply cannot control Hong Kong. The Chinese government has a particular aversion to disorder and to challenges to authority. It's not allowed on mainland China. It will feel its own authority will be undermined if it doesn't step in and stop this. I think there is a very real chance China comes in, but we can't even begin to quantify the consequences of that. No one's going to stop them. China is the predominant power in this region. The US will protest, no doubt, but there's no other foreign force that is going to come in and stop China from entering what is technically a sovereign part of China itself. But, you know, it would extinguish the commercial and cultural life of Hong Kong, or at least change it dramatically for a while. It would have unforeseen consequences. And I think that's probably what would make China pause. You know, they may feel they'll be calculating now how much they can withstand the humiliation of seeing their own government lose all control here in Hong Kong and being challenged by the young protesters, balancing that against all the consequences, many unforeseen, that will come from an overt Chinese intervention over the border.
The BBC's Jonathan Head talking to Miriam. The drama on one this week was River of Ghosts by Roger Gregg, and it packed more into 20 seconds than most soundscapes this week. One of the characters is a boy called Squanto, who grows up with his grandmother.
And so the boy grows up along the river with his mom and dad, Grandma Teresa, Granddad Archie, and Aunt Mamie. All natural, uninhibited, a free spirit, a beatnik, like Walt Whitman or Adam in the Garden. A left-handed boy in a right-handed world. Now, his grandma has a big organ in the dining room. The organ is a heavy, solid wooden thing with two banks of keys, a row of buttons to change the sounds, and even a bank of foot pedals. Mary bought it for her mother. His grandmother sets him up on the high bench and tries to teach him the proper fingering for scales. But the kid just wants to make weird, scary ghost sounds. The weirder the sounds, the more the boy laughs and laughs. Then he discovers the reverb button. Oh, reverb. Oh my, it's loads of fun making stuff up. His Aunt Mamie gives him a cowbell. This bell. Left over from when the family had the farm. The boy marches around the house banging on the bell, his mother screaming,
"Go outside with that thing! You're driving me crazy! What is it with you and noise? You want to play that? Take it outside!"
Cowbells and organs. Sure, it's loads of fun making stuff up. That was the drama on one, River of Ghosts. Ryan Tuberty is back from his holidays.
I'm just going, one more peck and going back to the nest. One more peck. I'm fine to fly. I just kind of... And then it's going, or so, and they're going, against him. I'm fine. Don't look at me that way. I'm not having a row with you.
Don't even ask. Back after the break. Welcome back. Miscellany 50 continued this week, and on Wednesday covered the years 2008 through to 2012. One contributor was Hungarian immigrant to Ireland, Bernarda Budda, who took to the vernacular Hiberno-English with gusto, after a fashion.
If I liked some colloquialism, I incorporated it into my chat. That's why I soon proudly began to open conversations with, "How's the farm?" When I first heard it, I thought, isn't this a lovely phrase? It seems to hail from olden days when most people had their own farms in the countryside. Surely! It has been around for generations and even wound its way into the vernacular of urban dwellers. It made perfect sense. The Irish, bless them, didn't bat an eyelid. Never mind anyone ever enlightening me that it's not the farm, for heaven's sake, it's the form. Oh, well, at least I tried.
Bernarda Buddha on Miscellany 50 on Wednesday. But our attitude to immigrants isn't always so warm, cosy and welcoming. On Monday, Ryan opened the programme talking about racism and the rise of extremism.
There's no point. There is no point in pretending anymore that there isn't a very vibrant vein of racism running through the veins to the body of this country. No point, because we get it here every time we talk to somebody who is quote unquote different, and the texts come in whoosh, in big numbers to say, send them home, to use the expression that we've been hearing over in the United States. And unfortunately, I think that these people who are racists are being facilitated by a bigger conversation and bigger leadership issues, be it in America, be it in Hungary, be it in France, be it in Italy, and it all feeds this beast.
Ryan was about to talk to Green Party councillor Hazel Chu, who had taken part in anti-racism protests at Google headquarters in Dublin. Google had suspended a user for violation of its policies on hate speech and harassment, and there were tensions, big tensions, around race, immigration and free speech. Now, Hazel Chu is Dublin-born to parents of Chinese heritage, and she had received a tweet describing her as that migrant, which sparked a whole spat about just how green her Irish was, and the nastiest of name-calling.
Ah, I've been called everything that rhymes from, that goes from just your average witch and the other one that rhymes with witch to something that rhymes with James Blunt. So, and being told everything to go back to where I came from, some hellhole, according to some people. Mm. Firhouse is not a hellhole, I have you know. They were referring to China.
Of course.
And everything under the sun, and it came in floods. And the thing is, through this all, everyone kept on saying, oh, stop playing the victim, stop playing the victim. I'm not. At no point did I say, oh, woe is me. At every point did I say, this is not on. But for me, what had happened was, after the messages, I kind of thought, well, you know, it's
that
messages.
It happens,
you know. But then what happened was then the phone call. The first phone call, I was at home with my little one and picked it up, and there was just heavy breathing on the call. And I thought, ah, it's one of those. So I thought, that's fine. But then by the sixth phone call, I kind of realised, you know what? This is actually just not cool.
And the weekend protests had brought out some extremely ugly behaviour.
What I saw on Saturday was Nazi salutes, so which I found shocking. How is this okay? You're talking about a salute that was associated to a huge amount of harm. So again, it's back to that whole, yes, we do have freedoms and we should protect those freedoms, but they cannot cause harm to people.
Hazel Chu with Ryan Tuberty on Monday. On Tuesday, Miriam O'Callaghan spoke to Dr. Paul Stocker, Senior Fellow at the Centre for Analysis of the Radical Right, about the rise and rise of far-right politics in the world. And given that we're not so far removed from the fascism of the 1930s and World War II, are we really so quick to forget the lessons of history?
People do not have a memory, a living memory of fascism and the horrors of the Second World War. And I think there's that, and many of these parties have rebranded themselves away from fascism. So if you look at the British National Party, which isn't very significant anymore, or the National Front in France, they do not adopt many of the policies or strategies of fascist parties of the past. They talk much more about identity rather than race. They talk much more about democracy rather than the need for an authoritarian state. So I think both the public has become more desensitized to right-wing populism, but also the parties have themselves rebranded and tried to present themselves as something new and different.
And what other tactics are employed by those on the far right?
The reason why polarization works for the far right is because they claim that they are on the sides of ordinary people and their opponents are part of some decadent liberal elite. And that's proven a very, very successful strategy. And the free speech narrative has been something that's been used by the far right very effectively now for decades. Even if we are being racist, we're entitled to be racist because it's free speech. In terms of countering that, I suppose you have to be honest about what free speech actually means. It doesn't mean you're allowed to just say what you want, no matter what the effect on people. You have to look at genuine free speech issues when people are trying to shut down debate and when they are trying to incite racial hatred, which is often what the far right is trying to do.
Dr. Paul Stocker from the Centre for Analysis of the Radical Right, talking to Miriam O'Callaghan. Over on Mooney Goes Wild, Derek spoke to Helga Soffland about the James Bond of the sea, Vladimir, the beluga whale who'd been found in Norwegian waters in April. And it seems that spycraft has gone up a notch.
He came in there and he was wearing a harness, a GoPro camera harness actually, and it said St. Petersburg on the harness, and it was sort of military web coloured and everything. A lot of back and forth, and a local fisherman jumped into the sea and cut the harness off the whale, and the whale followed the boat to shore, and this sort of taken up his own permanent place in the Bay of Hammerfest. They sent this harness to the intelligence services, and they tried to sort of figure out where it could come from. And there is a pretty good consensus that this is some kind of military-trained animal. This facility up in Polyany in the Arctic region of Russia, who are kind of known, or at least in the West, suspected to be training animals for this kind of purpose. And I know the principal scientist who worked this case, and he at least is very certain that this animal stems from somewhere around there. The whale... He just loves people, apparently.
Mm-hmm. Because he's intelligence gathering. Well, such is his love of people that he is now a mini celebrity and eating the Norwegians out of house and home with his herring habit. A hefty €20,000 worth so far. And he's quite the operator.
And he's such a charmer because he there was a woman who went to see him and she bent over the side of the boat and her phone was like going into the sea and going to the bottom, and she was like, oh no, my phone, I'll never see it again. And the whale went down and he picked it up and came back up and handed it to her.
With all her data mined, as my mother used to say, never trust a beluga whale. Now Brenda Donoghue is sitting in for Ray, and she spoke to three drag queens with spectacular names but a slightly loose understanding of time.
Good morning.
Afternoon, Pat.
It's morning for drag queens, how dare you?
And Brenda asked Victoria's Secret to describe how she achieved her look.
I think in drag I am touching 7 foot, let's say. I am obsessed with leotards, which, I mean, is not very becoming of a lady, but hey, there we are. And
Brenda is pointing to
areas down beneath at the moment. I mean, yeah. I'm very confused what she's pointing at, but yes, I use something that is similar to like a couch padding. Shove it down your tights, and all of a
mattress
sudden,
Mick.
Right. You go from Mick to Kim Kardashian in one swoop of a mattress.
Literally.
Pure filth. And then Victoria's Secret talked about coming out twice. Once as gay, and then as a drag artist.
I started doing drag and I was still living at home. So I had this, you know, bag of drag sitting in my bedroom, which I hadn't like spoken to anyone that I was doing some drag shows. And then my mother, because she is a classic Irish mother who opens your post before it gets to your bedroom, found this bag, opened it up and sat me down going, so we need to have a chat, what's going on here? And I was like, well, I'm doing some drag shows. And she was like, okay, and are you confused about your gender? And I was like, she was straight down like 60 stories ahead of me already. And I was like, no, but I think it took her a while to see what drag was about and that you
it was
were
fabulous.
It was great crack, but also it was a job. We were like making money and paying bills through it, and so it was a bit like coming out twice.
Well, they'd all been in drag for about 15 years, and although there was much more openness on the scene these days, there weren't always opportunities for new queens, or, as they liked to put it,
to be honest, there's not actually that many, because there's again, it's a small pond.
Closed. You but don't want anybody in.
No, it's not.
Nobody's
that.
Dying and nobody's retiring.
Yeah,
it's like Orti.
Out of the mouth of drag queens. That was with Brenda Donoghue. This week, Brainstorm with Ella McSweeney explored the concept of car-free cities. Here's David O'Connor from Technological University, Dublin.
What do we actually mean by car-free cities? Okay. But are we literally talking about taking cars and getting them out of the cities completely or not?
It's actually quite a problematic expression because as soon as you say it, you get a lot of people get their backs up and say, well, actually, I need my car. So you're trying to take my car away. So that means that, you know, that sort of divorces me from where I work, maybe taking family to school or whatever it is. So people sort of see that as, you know, a very aggressive, a car-reduced city centre. And that's what we're really, really talking about. And there are sort of famous Groningen is, you know, has the highest cycling statistics in the world. And simply what they did was they cordoned off the city, and it meant that you couldn't go through the city anymore.
In Holland?
In Groningen and Holland, I beg your pardon. You could get from one side of the city to the other, but you had to go outside and around. So there was car access, but it just meant it was reduced. And by doing that, it means that now your public transport works much, much better. That starts to suck in trips. It starts to generate revenue. They can improve the services. So you've got this virtuous cycle.
And Ulf Strohmeyer from NUI Galway spoke about leadership, making possible what might have seemed impossible. He highlighted the work of Paris Mayor Anne Hidalgo.
She's really inserting cycle lanes into the heart of Paris, even along boulevards or roads that I would have always conceptualised as being, you know, the main throughways. You know, here's four cars side by side jostling for space, you know, bumping into one another, all that you associate with less Northern European sort of car spaces, you know, and all of a sudden there's just one lane and there's a major, major cycle path right next to it where bicycles can go both ways, you know. I wouldn't have thought that possible, but it is possible. You see it in action and you say, scratch your back of your head and say, why didn't we do that 30 years ago?
Oh, two wheels always best. That was Car-Free Cities on this week's Brainstorm with Ella McSweeney. For 10 days, Noor Kawong had been missing in Malaysia, and everybody's thoughts had been with her and her family. But on Tuesday, the worst came to pass.
Police in Malaysia searching for missing Irish teenager Noor Kawong say a body has been found. From Malaysia, Jackie Fox reports.
At 4:30 here in the Doosan Rainforest Resort, police confirmed that a body has been found during their search for Noor Kawong. They said a man found the body just before 2:00 local time. 30 minutes later, police were at the scene.
Jackie Fox reporting the tragic news that no one wanted to hear. And Nora's local parish priest, Father Marcus Holden, at St Bede's Catholic Church in London, spoke of the community's response.
People are absolutely heartbroken and devastated by it. And people relate to this, and they loved Noor very much. She had special needs, as we all know. And when you have a child like that, it brings out a lot of love in a community. During these days, I've never seen such an outpouring, and I think that's one good thing to come out of this terrible, terrible time.
Father Marcus Holden in London. We'll be back after this break. Welcome back. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is the new film from the enfant terrible of L.A., Quentin Tarantino. Leonardo DiCaprio is an actor. Brad Pitt is his stunt double all down in the valley in 1969. Now, it starts off very well, but we know that it will culminate in the Manson murders. And it's how Tarantino handles this that Arena's reviewers took issue with. Here's Yvonne Nolan and Daryl Jones.
Beautifully observed, really good character stuff all the way through, and how the ensembles work all the way through is really good, but it's clunky and disparate.
And you're upset by the end of the film, aren't you, Darl? We know that it's ending up in Cielo Drive and the horrors that are going to happen there, but you're unhappy with it.
Very. I think there are serious ethical issues here. And my feeling,
and I do too.
My feeling coming out of it was, you know, if I'd have left 40 minutes before the end, I'd have seen a much better film. You know, this is an atrocity we're dealing with here. So and so all the way through, as if I'm saying, you know, what was going on through my mind was, well, how is he going to do this? Is it going to take place off screen? This is something that requires tact and delicacy, and these are not qualities that Tarantino possesses. He possesses lots of other very good qualities, but not those ones. So I was quite horrified by the ending.
Yeah, and me too. It's just, I don't want to seem all stiff and proper, but the ending was offensive and tasteless. You know, it was okay in Inglourious Basterds that, you know, the baddies were Nazis, that somehow the rewriting of history there, you know, sort of worked. But the rewriting of history where you're talking about a group of drug-addled, homeless teenagers, as the Manson family disciples largely were, it's a completely different thing. And there are huge, huge ethical problems with the fictional reenactment of what happens at that stage.
No, my. So stars then, Daryl?
At one point I thought, this is the best Tarantino film since Pulp Fiction. So there's lots to like about it, and one very, very bad thing. So I guess three.
And Yvonne?
2.5 out of 5.
So that end damaged it more than it did even for Daryl.
Yeah, I was in a state of shock when I came out of the cinema. I really was. It took me a while to get over it.
Film Reviews on Arena with Kay Sheehy. Paddy O'Gorman headed to a car boot sale in East Belfast, and he spoke to Carol, who'd moved here from England.
You have a London accent.
I was born in the East End of London. I married a Belfast man. Been here 49 years and I love it. I would never, never go back to London.
Since 1970?
Yes, just in the middle of the Troubles. He was a male nurse in the psychiatric hospital, and then when he came over, he was a policeman. He did the evenings. He was a part-time policeman, but it was still bad in those times, you know, where we lived. Live in Wyndham Street, just off the Cliftonville Road.
Right.
Twice that I was cornered in a shop and told to off because I was English, and plus I was giving all the soldiers tea at night when they used to come round, and I used to give them tea and biscuits and stuff. So we got an album. So then we had to leave. They moved us over here.
What's your feeling now, looking at it all?
I thought we had peace like a few years ago, but it's starting to blow up again. And we don't know what about Brexit. Mm-hmm. What's going to happen about Brexit? Are we going to still carry on as we are? Is the border's going to be shut or whatever? But that doesn't worry me because I'm not into politics at any rate. I don't care what religion you are, mm-hmm. as long as you leave me alone.
Carol talking to Paddy O'Gorman in Belfast, as heard on Miriam O'Callaghan. And later on Liveline, Bridget was another voice from the North who spoke about occupying a middle ground and living her life as best she could amidst the Troubles.
And is Northern Ireland, Bridget, still a fractured society?
Is it? It's hard to say. On a day-to-day basis, no. But I would say that the hurt that has been caused by each to the other since 69 has made it, more, we've given ourselves more history to feel hard done by.
More
history. You know what I mean?
We've given ourselves more history to feel hard done by.
But on both sides. I mean, yeah, on both sides. This side has the ability to say, what about, and we're famous for what about Italy.
Well, there's nearly 4,000 people killed.
Absolutely. And the grief and the sadness and the, but everybody's still trying to be justified and using terms like, you know, freedom fighters, or Dave was talking about the medal with the GAA medal, which had the tribute to, I wasn't quite sure.
One of the hunger strikers, yeah.
One of the hunger strikers. Yeah. I find their deaths tragic beyond belief. I really do. They're held up as heroes. And yet I think their poor lives, what were they lost for, you know? Like their mothers and their brothers and their sisters lost them, never spent another day with them. And for what? Are we near a united Ireland today or an Ireland united? I don't think so.
Bridget with Joe on Monday. Now, Kilkenny's Brian Cody faces off against Tipp's Liam Sheedy in the hurling on Sunday. And on Morning Ireland, John Murray asked commentator Michael Deignan how he saw it going down.
There won't be an inch given by either of them, and I don't think there'll be an inch given by any of their players, because that's what those two managers... I just think both of them have an ability to nearly bring their own personality and their own will to win.
Will you call it for us?
I think Tipp will do it, and nearly everyone I met, I said Tipp, and nearly everyone said back to me, no, Kilkenny. So
okay.
The people on the, I think I went against them in the Limerick and Cork matches and got it wrong.
Right.
It could be 3 in a row, but I just have a sneaking suspicion Tipp can do it.
Michael Deignan putting his money down. In a week where pay and conditions in our defence forces were in the news, Ryan Tuberty spoke to former soldier Chris Donovan, who had served 8 tours of duty in the Lebanon in the 1980s and had witnessed a truly horrific act of violence.
There was this family we used to give
bread to. We got this bread and it was rock hard. You couldn't eat the stuff. So we used to give to them. So a mother and two daughters, they were nice. So we used to give them this and they subsisted on it. They'd grow their vegetables, whatever, in the garden. But they'd get the bread and they'd dip it in. They'd leave it setting in milk and then dip it in honey and eat it. You know, milk and honey. These people had nothing. But this man, anyway, there was a young one there. She was 15. Her name was Mona Karani. And she was picking aubergines. And, sorry, get a little it's upset with this.
Yeah, because you were how old at this time?
I was, I think it was 19.
19. So you were kind of like a boy yourself.
I was a pup.
And this girl you're describing was how old?
Yeah, she was 15.
And she was picking aubergines.
Yeah. But Khalil walked straight past the front of the APC and took a pistol out and he shot her in the head. And you're not that far away. And he shot her in the back of the head and she dropped like a stone. And he did it because he could do it, because he knew he had the protection.
But you witnessed this execution. You were not too far away. What did you do? Did you go to her?
I went to shoot Khalil, but he dropped the pistol. I can't shoot an unarmed man.
He knew what he was doing.
He played the rules, turned around and he ran off. He ran down, he ran through the house, the family's house, down the wadi, and was collected and brought off by the Israelis.
Chris eventually did come home, but he had developed post-traumatic stress disorder. And going to the cinema to see Saving Private Ryan sparked off unforeseen effects.
Opening scenes at Curragh Cloe, it wasn't the visual part of it. That was okay. It was realistic enough, but it was the sound of bullets hitting steel.
Yeah.
I was transported from there back to an incident where that was the sound. That was the overriding sound of the incident. I was there again. And I crawled out of the cinema and the girl at the door just laughed and said, "What are you?" And I went, I couldn't even speak. I was shaking.
It's like a panic attack almost.
Yeah, I burst into tears and I couldn't stand. I had to crawl. I crawled out of the cinema on my hands and knees.
Did you?
Yeah, that's it. That's it. And I went across to the Swiss cottage and I took some permanent lodging in a beer glass.
Chris made two attempts to take his own life, but eventually found the help he needed. But he acknowledged that his time serving abroad had left him with permanent scars.
See, I've had to accept that this is a part of me.
Okay.
This will never go away. It will never...
You're showing me the piece of tissue that you have pretty much mangled for the last half an hour in the course of this conversation, which probably explains...
Well, I've run out of fingernails.
Out of nails.
Sorry.
That's all right. What are you thinking?
Fight or flight.
Chris Donovan with Ryan Tuberty. Over on Drive Time, Fergal Keane went on a jaunt to the Royal College of Surgeons in Dublin to get up close and personal with some of the medical instruments on show as part of an exhibition to mark 235 years of the college. He spoke to librarian Ronan Kelly, who talked him through the rather more gruesome instruments on display. And prepare to wince.
For people on the radio, it looks very like a corkscrew because it operates very like a corkscrew. It's a trepanning set for making a hole in the head, a small hole in the cranium. If there was a bleed on the brain, a hematoma, and pressure needed to be relieved, you needed to make that hole. Now, interestingly, neurosurgeons today still have to make a hole, but generally speaking, if they take out a disc of bone, they'll pop it back when they're done.
This is like a circular saw. Did people have anaesthetics for this?
This one here will date from the early 19th century. This and almost everything at the table here predates anaesthesia. So what would happen is he would take a swig of brandy, the patient would take a swig of brandy, and off they would go.
Which is just how you want your surgeons liquored up and wielding sharp instruments. On Thursday, Brenda Donoghue spoke to Marie Carberry and her daughter Rachel O'Neill. Marie has terminal cancer and has been given 6 months to live. And although this was an interview about death, it was also very much about life and living. And here, Rachel talked about how she had reacted to the initial cancer diagnosis a few years ago. And it's fair to say she was a pretty typical teenager. In other words, me, 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 me.
What age? Teenager?
15. I think I was doing my junior cert.
Oh, God. What was that like?
Oh, it was... I think I was 15, so I was your typical teenage. Oh, this is terrible.
It's all about me.
It's all about me, though. What about my junior cert? As if that mattered in any regard.
Yeah.
But I remember being I remember being upset, but I remember being more upset that I didn't understand why Mum wasn't able to, like, drop me to the bus or let me... Like, I remember just being more angry. Like, I didn't understand how serious it actually was. Because we heard breast cancer. I didn't hear triple negative till I was much older. Mm. So it was more about, oh, Mum's got cancer. Oh, Mum's bald. Oh, God, that's weird. And then, oh, it's gone again. Okay. Like, it was hard. It was really hard. But I think when you're 15, you're just more narcissistic and self-involved. Yeah.
And although Mary's cancer went away for many years, it came back with a vengeance. And her response was to cash in the pension and globetrot.
All I'd ever wanted to do was travel, myself and my husband. So I said, this is my chance, baby. So I got together as much money as I could and we blasted it.
Where'd you go?
Oh, we were in India four times. We were in Thailand. We were in Cambodia. We were in Vietnam. We were in Laos.
Japan.
We were in Japan. And we just gave it the holly. I'd worked in the Bank of Ireland for 20 odd years and my pension was due. So rather than leave my pension where it was and let it die with me, I took it out.
Good for you.
And gave it a lash. And I never regretted it.
When you were travelling,
yeah,
did you feel like I am a sick person?
Never.
What did you feel like? That. No.
I felt lucky that I was there. It was such a privilege to be able to go. It's such a privilege to wake up every day without pain and just go out and live my life. It's been a privilege, you know. It hasn't changed me as such, you know, and made me holier than thou or whatever. Yeah. But
God forbid, yeah.
But it did give me a different perspective on material things, I suppose, which is holier than thou, you know. But it just made me appreciate everything all the more.
And then Brenda asked a pretty profound question, which yielded a rather unexpected answer.
Do you think about, well, if I'm not around, Rachel gets married, kids, grandkids, all of that. Is that tough? Is that really a hard question?
No, it's not a hard question. And it's, yeah, it is, because I will miss that. But maybe I won't. Mm. You see, that's the thing. Maybe I won't. But we were talking about this last night about what would you miss? And I said, I really want to see the end of Brexit. Like, I really do. You know, I want to get closure on Brexit. And she's saying, oh, you're such a nerd.
Listen, we'll all be gone before that happens.
That's true. That's true.
That is true.
Yeah.
Seriously. God damn it, is no place Brexit free. But now, with the reality of that 6 month diagnosis, how are they both coping with life?
I don't think I've stopped being in shock since about January of this year, to be honest. You just kind of go with it. And Mum makes it a lot easier because, you know, you can get upset, and I do get upset, but she's always had the attitude of, we'll just keep going until we can't anymore, kind of. So, like, she'll take all the medications, she'll take all the treatment options, and also, it's not like we're all sitting there in a circle counting down to her inevitable demise.
Sorry,
like,
it's terrible talking about
it. No, it's not. It's reality.
It just is. My situation just is, and I wake up every day and I say, well, this is it. Not this is it, sorry.
No, not this is it. Yeah.
This is what it is. Or today is, there is only today.
Yeah.
There is only today for me.
A lesson in how to live well. That was Marie Carberry and her daughter, Rachel O'Neill, talking to Brenda Donoghue. So we might as well dance. Viva Las Vegas. Viva.
Viva Las Vegas with your neon flashing and your one-armed bandits crashing all those hopes down the drain. Viva Las Vegas turning day into nighttime, turning night into daytime. If you see it once, you'll never be the same again. I'm gonna keep on the run, I'm gonna have me some fun. If it cost me my very last dime, if I wind up broke, oh well, I'll always remember that I had a swing in time. I'm gonna give it everything I've got. Lady luck, please let the dice stay hot. Let me shoot a seven with every shot. Viva Las Vegas! Viva Las Vegas! Viva! Viva!
That is all from Playback for this week. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.